It's Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock. You're listening to Political Rewind, 5 days before the Iowa caucuses take place next week. With me today, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and the, I guess, editor is a fair enough word, of Political Insider blog.
Founder
of Political Insider blog. Todd Ream, who has his own blog, GeorgiaPundit.com, which is a daily online report on what's going on in national, state, and local politics. He's also a Republican consultant. Mike Thurman, let's see, how do we list his credentials? Former Commissioner of Labor for the state of Georgia, former Democratic state representative, his first big job in politics, former superintendent of the DeKalb County Schools, and last but not least, ran for the United States Senate as a Democrat in 2010. And Eric Tannenblatt is back with us. Eric, of course, is one of the closest, I think, to the Bush circle, all of them, George H.W., George W., and Jeb, of anyone we know in town. And he's been involved with the Bush campaign, as he is with many other Republicans running for office here and across the country. And I have to say that as we were coming out of the news, Eric and Mike are passing notes back and forth like two like school kids at Marist, you know. So we'll catch up on what that was all about in a little while.
We're old friends.
Okay. We do have some breaking news to start the show off. Bernie Sanders, just about an hour ago, came out of a meeting with President Obama at the White House and talked to reporters. He said this. And I think these are interesting comments. I'm not quoting him directly, but pretty close. I don't think we're going to do in Iowa what Obama did in 2008, when, of course, Obama upset Hillary Clinton in a pretty big way. If there's a big turnout, we can win, but we'll move on to New Hampshire. And then he said, I think we'll do better in the South than people think. Jim, I would assume that this meeting was arranged rather hastily by the Sanders people with the White House after the president gave his interview to Politico the other day and seemed to tip toward Hillary Clinton. I suspect the Sanders people said, hey, give us a break here.
Right, right. I mean, in the Politico interview, Obama said that he was comparing, I think, Sanders and Hillary Clinton and kind of gave some weight to Hillary's realistic approach to politics.
Yeah, yeah. I do think it's interesting, Eric. He seemed, although, you know, Sanders is kind of a guy who speaks his mind, so you never quite know if he's massaging a comment for public consumption. He seemed to downplay Iowa just a little bit in these remarks in front of the White House.
Yeah, it's expectation setting.
Yeah.
I think he wants to lower expectations, so if he wins, if Sanders wins Iowa, that's very significant because I think everyone assumes he's going to win New Hampshire because he's from a neighboring state. But if he wins Iowa, and it's not predicted that he will, he's going to have a head of steam not only going to New Hampshire but coming into the South.
Okay, so that's the headline story from the last hour, and we'll get back to that Democratic presidential race in a little while. But we really, I think Todd Ream, really the story that is dominating political news for the last 2 days has been the escalation of the war between Donald Trump and Fox News, and specifically Megyn Kelly. Trump has now said, he said last night, we're not going to have anything to do with the Fox debate tomorrow night.
I continually find myself bouncing back and forth between thinking how shrewd Donald Trump is and how he must have just woken up with a wild hair that day. I can't tell if he's being smart in picking these fights because he has there's no one else to compare him to. You can't say this is like 80 something or 90 something. There's nobody else like Donald Trump. But that's also makes it high risk for him, and it's interesting to see in the last couple of weeks it looks like you're seeing a candidate reacting to stress that we haven't seen before. He's always been out there, he's always been bigger than life, but he's gotten a little more snappish. The character of his taunting of his foes has really sharpened.
Well, let's listen to how this escalated just briefly. really Trump started it. He started making comments a few days ago about Megyn Kelly. He's, you know, Trump, Jim, always says, well, I just react. I don't attack unless I'm attacked.
I don't know whether this is a presidential contest or a middle school
cafeteria brawl. Right. Okay. So Trump started going after the debate and Megyn Kelly. And this is, he made the statement we're going to listen to now in a news conference before his final decision that he wasn't going to debate. Let's listen to what he said.
Fox is playing games, yeah. Fox is going to make a fortune. I told Fox you should give money to the wounded warriors. I'm not a fan of Megyn Kelly. I think she's a third-rate reporter. I think she, frankly, is not good at what she does. And I think they could do a lot better than Megyn Kelly. But when they sent out the wise guy press releases a little while ago, I was all set to do the debate. I came here to do the debate. When they sent out the wise guy press releases a little while ago, done by some PR person along with Roger Ailes, I said, bye-bye.
So, Mike Thurman, the wise guy press releases started coming out 2 days ago from Fox. They decided, for whatever reason, and we should all discuss this, to sort of take a tongue-in-cheek, sarcastic approach to Trump's criticism of them, which I think is an interesting thing for a news organization to do. One of them said that Fox News officials, quote, had learned from a secret back channel that the Ayatollah and Putin both intend to treat Donald Trump unfairly when they meet with him if he becomes president. And the statement went on to say that Trump has his own secret plan to replace the cabinet with his Twitter followers to see if he should even go to those meetings. It's an odd way for a news organization to respond.
Yes, but this is astounding. And to consider that the leading Republican presidential candidate is taking on Fox News and Roger Ailes. It's unprecedented. What I think we're seeing in his worst case is an unraveling, but it better stated a realignment of the Republican coalition that has been extremely successful over the last 30 years of the business, major business, white working class, and evangelicals. Trump has basically dispatched Jeb Bush and the other establishment candidates. He's overtaken Ted Cruz and the evangelicals. And now Fox News, this one person, has taken on these almost insurmountable Republican figureheads and institutions and basically dispatched them. And so I don't think that no matter whether Trump wins the nomination or not, it would be very difficult to put this coalition back together again.
Anybody want to comment on that?
Well, number one, I think you're right. If you're a news organization and you put out a press release like that, you're not a news organization.
Yeah, I mean, we get attacked all the time.
You're into show business
right,
at that point.
Right.
And
right.
So and that's what this does. Trump does make a point. There is an entity in these debates that is making money, and it. Your cable news news network, and they are an essential partner in this. Eric, you'd probably know more about this, but there's a kind of an FCC exemption for news organizations that do debate. They don't have to do equal the equal time stuff. It frees them from that. So they're kind of essential to the process.
Well, let me interrupt for a sec. Here's what Fox said after Trump said unequivocally, "I'm not debating." We're not sure how Iowans are going to feel about Trump walking away from them at the last minute, but it should be clear to the American public by now this is rooted in one thing, Megyn Kelly, whom he has viciously attacked since August and has now spent 4 days demanding be removed from the debate stage. Capitulating to politicians' ultimatums about a debate moderator violates all journalistic standards, as do threats. And they accuse the Trump campaign of a word they don't call terrorizations, whatever the heck that non-word is.
Well, I mean, look, Trump is a bully, and Roger Ailes and Fox News is calling him on it. And, you know, I don't know where it will all end, but the people that are really I think Trump's really hurting are the people in Iowa. And, you know, this is a debate right before the Iowa caucus where Iowa voters want to see all the candidates. I saw some data within the last 24 to 48 hours that said 46% of Iowans still haven't decided how they're going to vote in the caucus, which is normal that they make their decision at the last minute. So debates like the one scheduled for tomorrow night could have an influence on how someone decides to vote. And so by Trump not participating, you know, there could be an impact into the results of what happened. There's already been question as to whether Trump's supporters will actually turn out at a caucus, because most of his supporters have never been to a caucus before. And it's not just like going into a voting booth and pulling a lever. I mean, you have to sit for, you know, in some cases, 3 hours and, you know, have a meeting in someone's living room or in a firehouse.
What I thought when you mentioned the tone of that first press release by Fox was that it reminded me a lot of what Ted Cruz has been doing. Trump calls Cruz a maniac, and Cruz comes back with a video from, was it Flashdance? Maniac, and sort of mocking Trump.
Yeah,
back.
And he did Fonzie jumping the shark.
Exactly, and what it looks like is that Cruz has found the closest thing to kryptonite for Trump is just sort of mocking him, and that was what I thought when I heard the press release.
All right, so go ahead,
why
Mike.
Should we be? I don't understand the whole notion about the press release. Look, fair and balanced. Fox is anything but fair and balanced. It's almost tongue in cheek. It has been very successfully the primary communication arm of the conservative movement in America.
You know,
everybody understands that it's anything but fair and balanced if you're on the left.
Jim, though, if you have covered politics for a long time, as you have, as I have, you are used to having people who interpret you as having biases, as being unfair in one way or another. And the one thing that I hope we can say proudly is that when those things happen, we continue to try to treat people as fairly as we can, not have these sarcastic replies.
You keep your mouth shut and you move on. What I'm interested here is now is what kind of a debate are we going to have Thursday night? Because I'm sure that all these candidates were going to put their sights on Trump.
Well, and that's a question about Jeb Bush?
I mean,
how is
Jeb Bush going to beat up on Donald Trump for insulting his mother?
Yeah, well, I think all of the candidates are going to have their shot at Trump, but I think they have to walk a fine line, because as soon as the debate is over, Donald Trump, after his wounded warrior event or whatever he's doing, is going to have a press conference, and he's going to be able to respond, and I'm sure every TV station is going to pick it up live, and he's going to get the final word. But I do think it's going to provide more airtime for some of the other candidates.
But Eric, in the long run, As a Jeb Bush person from the very start, does this help any of the mainstream candidates, including your candidate Bush, not to have Trump there? Yes, they'll all get more time, but how do you debate against a front runner who's not there?
Well, I think it's going to give the four candidates, the Bush, Kasich, Rubio, Christie, one of those four is going to come out of this thing long term. And I think that what this debate will do is provide those four candidates an opportunity not just to talk to Iowa voters, but to talk to New Hampshire voters, South Carolina voters, and really get their message out. And they won't have to compete with Donald Trump.
So in a way, given that you're part of a campaign that does want to present the mainstream alternative, Trump is playing into the hands of mainstream campaigns, you're saying, to help elevate their ability to talk to the people of the United States.
Here's the problem. Yeah. Here's the problem is that, yes, the Fox News debate is going to go on as scheduled tomorrow, but there's going to be a same time Donald Trump event. I will guarantee it.
I agree.
And CNN will cover it live. So Donald Trump gets his own TV show for that hour.
I want to revisit something that Mike said a second ago about Fox being established as sort of the voice that's in tune with Republican politics. One of the interesting things that points out the roiling mess that is the Republican electorate is that Fox is so frequently these days being accused of being too liberal or too establishment or too something else, not far enough right by the people that 3 years ago were the core of their audience.
Well, see, I didn't know that. And something Jim just said, to me, this is a big, and give Trump credit. The man, either he's brilliant or he's very lucky. Incumbent candidates or candidates with big leads in the poll, the last thing you want to do is be in what? A debate. Right. When he is strategically, and blamed it on Fox, taken himself out of the debate so that now he's no longer the target. I just think it's brilliant at the end of the day.
I agree with that. I think the person he hurts is Ted Cruz, because Ted Cruz is the one that is battling with Trump as to who is going to win the Iowa caucus. The expectations are that Cruz, up until about a week or two ago, was that Cruz was going to win. Now Trump has picked up some steam. But that does not mean that what I said before about elevating the other candidates and giving them an opportunity to get their message out is not going to happen. I think that will happen.
Well, with all due respect to Jeb Bush and all the other mainstream candidates, what you're essentially setting up here is the equivalent of what the kiddie table was like in the early debates. You really are, because suddenly, look, Carly Fiorina had an opportunity to suddenly emerge because the debate was much purer than with Trump in it at the bigger debate for a while. Rand Paul had a great night when there was that second tier approach. So in a way, without Trump there, you're saying the mainstream guys do have a showcase.
Well, yeah, but I don't think that anyone thinks that any of those mainstream candidates are going to win Iowa.
Right.
And I also don't think that the winner of the Iowa caucus is going to be the nominee necessarily of the party. They hadn't been in years past.
I want to talk about the mainstreamers in a minute, but excuse me, you mentioned Ted Cruz. Cruz has now, another kind of later breaking story, Cruz has now challenged Trump to a one-on-one debate because of the very reason you're describing,
yes.
Eric. He needs to get in the arena with him.
Right.
He's got to try to dirty him up a little bit. And their battle, Todd, you've watched a lot of campaigns in your young life as a Republican and as an analyst. I got to say, it's one of the most entertaining, if not necessarily substantive, battles I've ever seen. Let's listen first to a Ted Cruz super PAC. This is a super PAC spot that's now playing in Iowa, maybe on the air in New Hampshire. It's an anti-Trump ad about principles.
How much do we really know about Donald Trump on abortion?
She would not ban it.
No.
Or ban partial birth abortion.
No, I am pro-choice in every respect.
On health care.
Everybody's got to be covered.
Universal health care.
I am going to take care of everybody.
Well, who pays for it?
The government's going to pay for it.
Trump's even praised Hillary Clinton.
Hillary's always surrounded herself with very good people. I think Hillary would do a good job.
Can we trust Donald Trump?
There's a second super PAC out there, which is also going after Trump on largely the same issues, except they add the soundbite Donald Trump gave in a rally where the first poll appeared that showed him losing, coming in second to Cruz in Iowa, at which point he says, and I quote, "How stupid are the people of Iowa?" And the Cruz super PAC is using that against him. Let's listen very quickly. I don't want to play the spot. I'd rather play what Donald Trump's been saying about Ted Cruz on the stump.
Ted Cruz lies. He's a liar. And that's why nobody likes him. That's why his Senate people won't endorse him. That's why he stands on the middle of the Senate floor and can't make a deal with anybody. He looks like a jerk.
Middle school.
Wow.
I will tell you, but if we could just back up just
sure.
a little bit on this. I mean, we have got, I mean, what Donald Trump has done is he truly has created this giant question within the Republican Party as to who is a conservative,
yes.
and what is conservatism. And you've got the National Review. I think they devoted a whole issue to dumping on Trump. You've got this very, very stark split in the evangelical community. You had Jerry Falwell Jr. on one side endorsing Trump. You've got some regular Southern Baptist folks lining up behind Cruz. That's going to roil, and that's going to carry through on through to the state level in Georgia.
What do the Republicans say about this?
Well, look, the Iowa caucus is a critical event for both Trump and Cruz because the expectations game. If Donald Trump is the winner. You know, he's been talking about how he's a winner. He's a billionaire. He's successful. He knows how to make a deal. If he loses to Ted Cruz in Iowa, that's going to have a real impact on how he does in New Hampshire and the states after that. And so this could be the start of the downfall of Donald Trump. If Ted Cruz loses Iowa, which for months now we've been talking about, this is his state, it's made for him, this is going to have a real impact on him, because right after Iowa's New Hampshire, if Ted Cruz doesn't win Iowa, he's not going to have any steam going into New Hampshire. And I know he feels like he's got a, you know, a strong organization in the South and South Carolina, but there's going to be a 2-week period where he's not going to be talked about. And we all saw that with Rudy Giuliani when he banked, you know, put everything in Florida, and no one was talking about it.
Well, Todd, in that sense, he's a little bit like Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders if Clinton loses Iowa and New Hampshire. But unlike what Eric is saying, you've been keeping track very closely of how the campaigns are organizing down here. Cruz has pretty strong organization in place to turn south, doesn't he?
It is unlike anything I've seen in my years, and I'll give you two examples. One is that I've seen a number of friends of mine heading up to Iowa, and what's interesting about that is they are every single one of them going up to help Cruz. I don't know if that's because he's got a different set of people or because the campaign reached out, but I don't know anyone from Rubio. I don't know anyone from the Bush campaign.
There are people from the Bush campaign that have headed to Iowa already, and there are some that are heading to New Hampshire.
From Miami or from Georgia?
From Georgia.
But I've seen much more of that, and I take your word at that. I've just seen much more of that from Cruz. And the Georgia organization has bought their own yard signs and putting thousands of them out. They paid for a billboard out in Carrollton, and it's a very entrepreneurial campaign there. It's really fascinating to watch.
I was just going to say, of all of the campaigns, I would say you're right that Ted Cruz does have an organization in Georgia. But I'm just saying, if he loses in Iowa,
right, he's out of the headlines for a while.
Out of the headlines, and it will have an effect on your organization.
Can Jeb Bush or John Kasich, if they finish in the bottom tier, does it make any difference to you at this point, or is New Hampshire so important that you can shrug it off?
You mean in Iowa?
Yes.
No, I think that it's important the people that come in, you know, third.
You'd like to come
place
in third.
Well,
or fourth.
Obviously, the higher you can come up, the better. It helps you in New Hampshire. But I think New Hampshire is really the important state for those candidates.
Okay. Before we take a break, Mike Thurman, here's a great little gem that Jim Galloway and Greg Bluestein have in their Daily Jolt on Political Insider today. Lyle Larson, a state representative from San Antonio, Texas, as long as we're talking about Iowa, has said, Jim, you should take the first shot at this and let Mike. He said, shouldn't Georgia have its day in the sun? Why does it have to be Iowa? What the heck is that? Why is a Texas lawmaker trying to promote Georgia as the pre-Iowa state?
What he's trying to do is promote this idea that the parties ought to be rotating.
Right.
The state goes
yeah.
first.
Right. Okay. Right.
And that, you know, Georgia needs at least one shot at being in there. The curious thing about that movement is it's been pitched by a lot of people as a way to keep the crazies out of the race, if you will, to tamp down the extremes.
I don't think it's been working.
And,
so far.
And I'm just looking at Trump and I'm saying, where is that working? Yeah,
Mike. Well, plus, if you look at Iowa and the philosophical makeup of the Republicans and Democrats, they're not representative of particularly the National Democratic Party or the Republican Party. And I think we make a mistake, and we'll talk about it more, to put too much emphasis. What, some 40%? Was that self-described socialists who were Democrat? What was that percentage, Jim?
No, I don't know that one.
That's exactly right. That's in Iowa.
In Iowa.
Democrats.
Self-described socialists.
More than 40%, actually. So, I don't have the number
in front
of me.
You know, the fact that Bernie Sanders has a 2 or 3 or whatever point lead is not surprising. And because of the demographics of the Iowa Democratic Party is not representative.
Yeah, that's
the
William Jennings Bryan effect.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a break, get our first break out of the way. It'll be a short one. When we come back, let's talk about the Democratic race in Iowa, because that's become really fascinating, too. It's 2:30 on a Wednesday afternoon. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, the Iowa caucuses. We talk with Trip Gabriel, a New York Times political correspondent who's been reporting from Iowa for the past year. We'll talk with him about following the upheavals in the Republican and Democratic campaigns and about Iowa voters and their reactions to the candidates. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. Mike Thurmond is with us, Eric Tannenblatt, Todd Rehm, and of course, Jim Galloway from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. So something really fascinating. Todd Rehm, by the way, is tracking down a late-breaking Trump statement. Todd?
I'm finding out now that it was somebody characterizing Trump.
Okay, all right. Essentially,
but we all believed it could have come out of his mouth.
Essentially saying it takes a lot of guts, although that's not the part of the anatomy that the tweet refers to skip the last debate before the caucus. Fascinating story, Jim Galloway, that came out of South Carolina yesterday. You have an African-American Democratic legislator, Justin Bamberg, who has gained some recognition across the country because he's the attorney who's representing the Scott family, Walter Scott being the man who was killed by a police officer last spring in South Carolina. And Bamberg switched his support this week from Clinton to Sanders. Let's listen real quickly to what he said and then talk about it.
The more I inform myself, I realize that Bernie Sanders, I believe, is the man for the job. And I think he will do an amazing job as president. He makes a very clear stance on health care. He believes that health care is a right to every American citizen. And I wholeheartedly agree with that. When you hear from me, you're hearing from someone who represents a very poor and very rural district. Just last week, the second hospital of two closed down. Healthcare is a very real issue that needs to be addressed.
Jim, is he an outlier or could he be the start of something big?
I think with enough time, which he doesn't have, he could be the start of something big. I think if we were 6 months out and this was happening, then yeah, if I were Hillary Clinton, I'd be a little bit worried, and I'd be sending somebody to his office just to have a nice quiet chat.
Let me get the Democrat in, or Mike Thurman, and then come back to you, Todd, because I know you want to talk about this. Mike Thurman, certainly, Representative Bamberg got himself on the national map with this statement. I mean, he's been all over every cable news show out there. Since then, and it can't be good news for the Clinton people just to see him there talking about how great Sanders is.
Well, not necessarily. I went to law school in South Carolina. I was over there doing King Week in Anderson, South Carolina, and the South Carolina primary is unlike anything you can ever imagine. And what really happens is that, you know, sometimes you make a decision. If you got 100 people in one line, say the Clinton line, you can be the 101st person, or you can step into the Sanders line and be number one. So, and this is what I did. I remember when I endorsed Paul Tsongas, right?
I forgot that you did that.
I like Paul. He's a great man, deceased now. But all of a sudden, hey, you put me on Channel 2 News because I didn't know Paul Tsongas. But if I had endorsed Clinton, you know, Calvin Smyre and Dale Miller, the whole Democratic Party was in that tent. So sometimes it's just a strategic move on behalf of state and local politicians to get their seat at the table.
You're so right. I can't tell you how many candidates that I've worked for where I've gone to elected officials and said, would you consider endorsing? I'm like, well, what do I get out of it? I'd rather endorse someone else that doesn't have anyone on their team. Then I can be front and center.
And you remember, Bill. That's
I remember that.
This South Carolina representative doesn't carry nearly the weight that a John Lewis does, but it's got to be causing some hand-wringing in the Hillary camp, because that was how the Deep South started to fall against her in 2008, was when John Lewis switched from endorsing
it started with the young people. Your established African American politicians were all lined up behind Clinton, and then you had a youth movement start.
Yeah, I think you had a slightly different situation there, don't you, Jim? Because in that case, in 2008, the black leaders here who backed Clinton, they started coming under great pressure from other black citizens and other leaders. How can you do this? You've got the first African-American who could be president. So that played into it as well. But, Jim, you have a fascinating take on whether this could be meaningful or not. Who's your measure of whether there's any change coming in South Carolina?
Oh, yeah. Keep your eye on Jim Clyburn. And Jim Clyburn does not like the Clintons. He is probably the most powerful African-American Democrat in the state. I'm sure he is. If he starts, I think he has declared himself neutral. Am I right, Michael?
Yeah, he never endorses prior to.
Right,
but his organization is profound.
Right, and I think Hillary's employing some of his organization.
Yes.
But if Clyburn starts to raise serious public doubts about Clinton, then or start to say nice things about Bernie Sanders, then I think you do have something to worry about.
Black political leadership, South Carolina, Georgia, all through the South, they are wedded to Clinton. And look, you talked about the pressure. You're in the presence of a Clinton superdelegate in 2008. Talk about pressure, right? And I held the scars to prove it. To this day, right? But I stayed with her. But I want to talk about Iowa.
Are you a Clinton supporter now?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I want to talk about Iowa. I've been waiting 2 weeks to mention this. Iowa will be determined the most important candidate on the Democratic side in Iowa is Martin O'Malley. He will determine who actually, quote unquote, wins the Iowa caucus. And often overlooked, it's not a popular vote. It's about delegates. And in Iowa, the non-viable candidate, his delegates can actually switch. And the question that needs to be asked, if I'm supporting Martin O'Malley, the 3 or 4%, if I'm asked to choose between Sanders and Clinton,
where do I go?
Where do you go?
You make a good. Okay, so Democrats and Republicans have slightly different procedures on caucus night. Republicans basically just file into a caucus location and cast a ballot as if it were a polling place. But Democrats, as you point out, go in, they meet, they talk and talk, and then they do. They form into their corners. And you're right. If there's a corner with only three people, and that's if that's Governor O'Malley. Those people at the end of the night are told.
Or even during the night can actually walk to the other side of the room. And I'm telling you, I have heard unofficially that a tremendous amount of attention is being paid to Martin O'Malley and his delegates.
Interesting.
And I can't see Martin O'Malley, who's a moderate conservative Democrat, shifting or even giving permission for his supporters to move to Sanders.
You know how amazing that is? I mean, the Hillary Clinton team has spent something like $9 million in Iowa. Bernie Sanders has spent $7 million in Iowa. And Martin O'Malley has spent $200,000. It's been spent on his behalf. None of it has been his. I don't think he's got
any. But did you notice him at the town hall?
He was
the most confident guy on the stage. I mean, he took his jacket off, rolled up his sleeve.
He often is.
Yeah, he was in a really, really, I think, important
position. I think you make a good point. I just don't know how organized he actually is with people on the ground. But, you know, one thing with regards to Hillary Clinton that I think we can't lose sight. You know, there's some similarities between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders in that they're tapping into this anger in the electorate. And there's this anti-establishment mood out there. And Hillary Clinton is the epitome of establishment on the Democratic side, not to mention some of the clouds that are hanging over her with this email scandal. And so I'm not sure that that's also not a motivator for people that want something new and fresh. And I think Bernie Sanders is tapping into that.
And it's not Hillary. It's any established political figure, Republican or Democrat. We say it's Hillary, but it's also Bush, it's also Cruz, it's anybody
who the public really identifies
as being Washington-centric and long-term career politician. If you are one of those in this campaign, in this environment, you're in trouble.
Right, and so that's why the Southern firewall, I'm not sure, is going to help her as much as I think they think.
African-American.
Todd or Jim, in that town meeting the other night, had a moment that really took me aback. Even in the midst of a campaign that has been noted for being about the rudest we've ever seen, a young man who is a Sanders supporter stood up to talk to Hillary Clinton and said something about his friends and what they've had to say about her. He was standing within 20 feet of her, and here's what the exchange was like.
I've heard from quite a few people my age that they think you're dishonest.
Look, I've been around a long time. People have thrown all kinds of things at me. And, you know, I can't keep up with it. I just keep going forward. They fall by the wayside. They throw all this stuff at me, and I'm still standing. But if you're new to politics, if it's the first time you've really paid attention, you go, oh my gosh, look at all of this. And you have to say to yourself, Why are they throwing all of that? Well, I'll tell you why. Because I've been on the front lines of change and progress since I was your age. I have been fighting to give kids and women and the people who are left out.
So, Todd, what did you think of both sides of that exchange?
My first thought was it was obviously a plant. You know, they didn't just pick a kid out. He either on his own or with some assistance of other folks planned that question. Because when you stand up in front of a group of people to come out with something like that, you have to be committed to it. And politics is getting more confrontational in that way in just about every forum you see. But it also, Hillary's answer really nicely illustrates the tightrope she has to walk, because her biggest liability is her experience and having been around so many years. And especially with the younger voters. And I thought it also came off as pretty condescending to folks who might be getting involved in politics for the first time.
I don't know how she could answer that question and win.
but she
came close there.
Yeah, I thought she did too. But Todd apparently doesn't. But so, Mike Thurmond, you're the only one at this table, unless I'm mistaken, who has actually run for political office. Have you ever run, Todd? Eric, I know you haven't, right?
I ran for the student government.
Okay.
Todd remembers that.
So one of the other things, I know this is kind of off the topic of politics, but I don't think I could handle people talking to me that way. I don't want somebody to stand up in a forum and say that I'm dishonest. How do you develop the thick skin for that?
Well, first of all, the people who ask the questions or cast the aspersions, they don't really know you personally. It's not a personal attack. It's an attack based on media reports or what they've heard or what they may have gleaned. Although it hurts, and by the way, you volunteer for the duty. You don't go into this expecting ticker tape parades in every town you run in that you visit. And you learn to accept it. And I thought Hillary did a great job in answering the question, because after decades of being involved in the political fight that she's been in or that any politician is in, you're going to have people who love you and hate you all at the same time.
But I would say that is filtering down to closer to personal interactions. The DeKalb County Republican Party, some of their meetings get that way, not even talking to candidates and local elected officials, but just person-on-person throwing barbs is becoming the currency in
interaction.
How
do we get away from that, Todd? I mean, what can we do?
I'll tell you what I do.
Yes.
I turn off my television, and I try not to interact directly with Twitter. I post stuff, but I don't engage with other people, because that's where I think the nastiness gets worst.
Eric, your candidate, probably more than any other, has had to contend with the nasty atmosphere, because let's face it, Jeb Bush, like a lot of the members of the Bush family, has always tended to try to remain more civil, more gentlemanly, if that's a fair word to use here. They've never been about gutter politics. Now, they've hired people who are fine with it. Lee Atwater was not exactly a sweetheart.
But
they themselves,
right? Not including Eric.
Right, but they themselves don't like to go there. And that's hurt.
No, it has. I mean, one thing, you know, we'll Monday morning quarterback all this, when we get further along in the campaign. But I think one of the things that happened early on this cycle is Donald Trump defined people before they had a chance to define themselves. And Jeb's a great example of that. If you remember back in June, you know, we started calling him low energy. I mean, you know Jeb. I mean, people that saw him in Florida, he's the furthest thing from low energy. But I don't know that people really completely understood the power of Donald Trump's brand, that he was able to do that. And so they didn't punch back. And he did that not just with Jeb Bush, but he did that with a number of other candidates along the way.
Well, look at what success he's having with just a few words. He's great at finding words, low energy being a great example, with Cruz. He's nobody likes him. He's nasty. It doesn't take
He's Canadian.
It doesn't take anything more than that, Jim.
He wasn't born in the United States of America. Yeah. Let's go back.
Right. No, this is reality TV. That's right. And that's scary. This is network. This is Sinclair Lewis, it can't happen here.
Well, and that's why I'm not ready to throw in the towel yet, because I really do believe the field is going to get a lot smaller, and when you get it down to two or three candidates and you really have to focus on the issue, you can't talk with sound bites, and you're going to start having a discussion where you're going to see an adult that understands the issues, that understands, you know, some of the serious things that the President of the United States has
to deal with.
All
right, before we take a break then, I want to ask you this question. As you well know, there's a lot of conversation going on out in the Republican Party now about the fact that it's time for Kasich, Bush, Christie, maybe even Rand Paul, Marco Rubio. It's time for there to be some coalescing, and some of the candidates have to be thinking about it's time to move aside so that we can have a mainstream candidate who can get the support that's necessary to confront either a Cruz or Trump. Would Jeb Bush be willing to be that sacrificial lamb?
Well, I think it's too early. No one's voted yet. I mean, we saw last 4 years ago, you know, at this time, I think Rick Santorum was 7% in the Iowa polls, and he ended up winning the Iowa caucus. So I think we all need to wait until the votes are cast, and I think you need to wait until after Iowa and New Hampshire. And I think some of that will happen.
Okay, that's what I was going to say. Right. We do have to wait. But which of these people all look at themselves in the mirror in the morning and say, yep, I could be the next president.
Well, to Eric's point, in 2008 and in 2012, the larger field continued well into March, and so I don't think there's that much pressure. And ultimately, I keep coming back to the idea that this is the Republican Party that nominated George W. Bush and John McCain and Mitt Romney, and it's hard for me to believe they're going to nominate somebody who is so far away from that model as a national party.
If I were going to look at one person to drop out, it'd be Rand Paul. Simply because he's got a U.S. Senate race to
right.
run as well.
That's right. Good point.
But I think Chris with Todd and Eric, the laws of political gravity will reassert themselves. I'm just telling you, it's going to happen. And I think Eric and Todd are both right on that.
Well, and I also think that, you know, of the four we're talking about, both John Kasich and Chris Christie have put all their eggs into the New Hampshire basket. They don't have anything much beyond New Hampshire. And so that's going to be a challenge for them, too.
So as we go to a break, we should say that everything that was just said around this table is further proof that the South, Georgia, can be incredibly important after the campaign gets through Iowa and New Hampshire. When they turn to South Carolina and then come to Georgia, we're going to be right in the spotlight for the first time in many years. Very exciting.
Yeah.
All right, let's take our last break. You're listening to Political Rewind. It's 2:48. We'll come back, talk some state politics, and give everybody a chance to talk about the legislature.
Whether you know David Sedaris from his best-selling books, his appearances on This American Life, or his hilarious Santaland Diaries, you won't want to miss GPB's Evening with David Sedaris in Savannah on April 16th. Right now, you can receive premium seats before tickets go on sale to the public, and you can support GPB at the same time. Go to gpb.org/David. That's gpb.org/David. And thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. Jim Galloway of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Todd Ream of GeorgiaPundit.com, Eric Tannenblatt, who's been working very hard with the Jeb Bush campaign on this particular cycle, and Mike Thurmond, one of the best-known Democrats in politics in Georgia, and although he hasn't made up his mind yet, we know is going to be in the news one way or another, because within the next week or so, he's going to have to let everyone know whether he is going to run for chief executive officer of DeKalb County, right?
No comment. No, that's right. That's exactly
we don't
right.
know what he's going to say, but we know he has told us it's got to happen within the
Absolutely.
Next 10 days.
Looking forward to it.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about state politics. Jim, I think one of the more shocking stories that I've seen in the state in a long time broke earlier in the week. You all covered it incredibly well at the Constitution. Jeremy Spencer, an associate superintendent of the Department of Education, was nabbed because his Facebook page, which is apparently a combination of his personal page, but also a page he uses to communicate to teachers, to schools around the state, had posts on it that were just shockingly offensive.
I mean, a photograph of a lynching with the headline that says, "This is how you get rid of Obama. You impeach him and then dot, dot, dot."
Which was not his post.
No,
but someone else put it on his page and he let it sit there.
And he let it stay there. And he's another thing, he's also the brother of State Representative Jason Spencer.
Which also, if I'm correct, and if I'm not, I'm sure Jason Spencer will correct us. I think Jason Spencer said that his brother was a victim of political correctness.
He did.
I mean,
he did.
What do you say?
Well, here's what makes this just it's awful. It's awful. First of all, here's what makes it even worse is that you have thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of teachers in Georgia who have been lectured incessantly about keeping their social media clean. You have had teachers fired because they posted a photograph of themselves with a martini in their hand, and here you have an associate superintendent putting this stuff out.
Yeah, he was fired, summarily fired, very quickly. There were some cries of this is a violation of his First Amendment rights, that sort of thing. I suppose he could file suit.
With the EEOC, maybe? I don't think.
Well, actually, I'm going to be careful, because apparently that's one of the reasons that he may not have a leg to stand. Apparently,
he resigned
before
he resigned.
Because the superintendent can't fire him without approval from the board, state board, and he didn't want to wait for that sort of thing. Okay. Mike Thurman?
Just two things, though. Maureen Downey broke the story. Yep. Didn't she? Give her credit. I was proud of that. And Richard Wood did the right thing.
Very quickly.
Very quickly. So out of that, there are two positives that we need to recognize.
So,
good reporting and, I think, statesmanship.
Talk about your experience as superintendent of a school system as large as DeKalb, with a very diverse community of teachers and administrators, in monitoring how you, in that position, oversaw social media that was put out there with your people.
Well, constantly. But our greatest concern really was not so much the racially racist kind of posts, but we monitor on a constant basis any suggestions or threats associated with violence. And that's the thing that's most frightening. And some of those posts actually had a tint of violence associated with it. That's what bothered me, the lynching and some of the words and the suggestions. And that is unacceptable. It was appalling. And the superintendent did the right thing, and the person never should have been hired.
Jim Galloway, you personally had another great story this week. On Sunday, I think your column was on Allen Peak, or was it late last week?
Oh, it was late last week.
All right.
Late last week.
So remind people of what Peak told you.
All right. Well, so actually, this goes back to the lawmakers, the GPP on lawmakers early in the week, and Allen Peak, state representative from Macon, backer of cannabis oil production bill this year. We were talking about whether we're in a climate where somebody's going to ultimately go to jail over this, because yes, it is now legal for parents in Georgia to possess cannabis oil. They won't be prosecuted by the state, but it is illegal for them to cross a state line. That's a federal federal felony. It remains a class one drug here. So I had a follow up conversation with Peak, and I asked him if he had ever carried the drug, and he essentially said, yeah, he had.
He told you that at least, I think he didn't
want to. He delivered product
for at least one family, isn't
right.
that the way
yes,
he put
yes,
it?
Yes, he has, yeah.
And the governor has now essentially fired a shot across his bow saying, when Dr. King broke the law, he was willing to go to jail because he recognized his civil disobedience had a price. So this is getting serious.
And it is. And that's what civil disobedience is. You purposely break what you think is an unjust law, and then you take the consequences, and then you let society judge on that. And I'll tell you what, you had these parents immediately jump to Alan Peake's defense, saying, yeah, I'm breaking the law every day. Come get me.
And you also had, in recent weeks, there's a newspaper publisher up in Jackson County who's been making a great to-do about the fact that he's going to grow a marijuana plant one of these days when he gets around to it.
Oh, it's happening.
Because of his son. And I think what you've got is you've got a few folks who are showing some willingness to say, I'll take my chances with the jury on this, and as a way of protecting or drawing fire from the parents. If you've got a four-year-old kid who needs constant medical care, you can't go out and be a test case. Someone like Alan Peake or the fellow in Jackson might.
Eric, here's my question. This is a strange conundrum. Peake got a lot of praise last year for finally, after 2 years, guiding his bill to allow cannabis oil to be used in 7 illnesses. He now wants to expand that list. But there's no production in Georgia, and the governor has said, I won't sign a bill to allow production here. So essentially, all this shouting about you can now use cannabis oil is for nothing because no family here can acquire cannabis oil legally. It's a strange catch-22.
It is. And that's why we're talking about what we're talking about.
basically, look, last year when they passed the possession bill, they created a gray market here. They truly did. They put this cannabis oil kind of in this limbo between illegal and legal.
I think there might be sufficient sentiment for this in the legislature that you might get a two-thirds majority in both houses on some measure, and a constitutional amendment doesn't require the governor's signature.
Right.
I'm surprised that hasn't been brought to the table.
Mike, yet. I do think it's fascinating that Alan Peake the other day said, look, I mean, if a family really wants marijuana for their kid, they can go and buy it on the street corner. They can buy a couple of joints, not legally, of course, but again, pointing to the strange, bizarre world we're living in terms of whether marijuana ought to be allowed for medical reasons or not. But also we've got the situation where Peake wants to expand the number of illnesses, which I think critics may be able to rightly say is part of this slippery slope that worries them.
Well, not necessarily. Alan Peake is an interesting political figure and leader, and I think he's really fashioning himself and building himself quite a power base across the state of Georgia. And let's go back to Trump. The thing about Trump is not so much Trump, but the baby Trumps that are being created. You're going to have more Trumps at the state level, at the local level, in city council races. I'm just telling you, this is just the beginning.
All right. Are you comparing Alan Peake to Trump?
No,
he's saying that's how he's going to run his campaign
He's not towing the party line.
Time out.
And winning.
Time out. We're out of time. Michael
he
Thurman.
He may have that much money.
Michael Thurman, Eric Tannen, Blatt, Todd Ream, Jim Galloway. You are always a great group to have talk about politics in Georgia. Lawmakers is on the air at 7 o'clock. Tonight, I'm Bill Nygut. We'll be back Friday at 3 o'clock with our final show before the Iowa caucus. And Donald Trump's already said he won't be on that either. Have a great afternoon.